Schools. Peter Solman, through the Board of County Counselors Office.
Andrew Guthrie, PLS Engineering.
Eric Lima, SG Engineering.
Jamie Cousin, Gordon Ramis.
Jefferson, Moss, Resort.
Carolina, I like Park and Trail.
Diana, Development Engineering.
Chuck Prager, Community Development.
Brent Davis, Environmental Services.
Ron Waring, Environmental Services.
Great, thank you. Just a notification that the deed meetings are recorded and placed on the deed's website. And that if you have cell phones, either turn them to silent or off, please. Next on the agenda is to review and adopt the minutes. I will...
Mr. Chair, I have reviewed them and I move for adoption.
Okay, second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any discussion? None heard. I did have one item, I think, in here I saw. Under the TIF update, in the second to last paragraph there, discussion with everyone of TIF credits will be notified and asked for input, discussion followed regarding stakeholders input need for an open process. I think one of the discussions that we had with regards to that was to get people with TIF credits involved early in the process and not at the end when they start having hearings and workshops at PC and board. So if we could just amend that, I believe that that's what we did discuss, that there is some concern that was too late in the process for those with TIF credits to have a strong voice in the process. So with that, all in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? None seen. Next item will be to review upcoming events.
Upcoming events. The county business is continuing forward, but this is a little bit in flux relative to the specifics of the Board of County Counselors, their hearings, some of their work sessions and stuff. So one thing, as I understand it correctly, and Peter, please correct me if I'm wrong, but that we do have listed here, the county manager will be meeting with the Board of County Counselors every Wednesday at 10 a.m., which I think will be a new forum for what maybe had been held in times past of like work sessions, such like that. So more clarification, and Peter, maybe you can help us as you get into your session, but we do know that that's happening. I think for the month of January, we just simply invite you to go to the county's webpage. Under the grid there, it lists their agendas for any meetings as those things get more rearranged or formalized. So, and then with the Planning Commission, the work sessions and hearings, those are continuing as they have in the past. Two set work sessions that are actually a work session and a hearing. Work session actually this evening, January 8th, 5:30 p.m. on amendments to home business and multifamily codes. And then the hearing on that the following week on Thursday, January the 15th, 6:30 p.m.
Good, thank you. Next item on the agenda is to vote for the 2015 chair and vice chair. In the past, it's typically been that the vice chair is nominated to be the chair for that year, but that's not to say that can't be the case. That doesn't necessarily have to be the case this year. So I'll open up the floor for nominations.
Who's vice chair?
Who's vice chair?
Andrew. And he hasn't had the opportunity to sit here.
Thank you, Andrew.
Yeah.
I nominate Andrew for chair.
Okay, do I hear a second?
I second that.
All right. Any discussion? None seen. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? And there you go. Well, I'll stay here one last time to go for vice chair now. I'll open the floor for nomination for vice chair.
Well, since Terry isn't here, I feel like you should
be nominated. Lesson learned, right?
He hasn't. Chair yet.
He hasn't.
Don hasn't.
He has.
Steve hasn't. And Ott's already a chair of a board.
And Terry has. Any volunteers?
I'll take it.
I nominate Don.
Good. Any discussion? None seen? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? Very good. Guess what, Andrew? You get to sit here now.
You're going to drop me right into it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll help you out, though, because I've got some stuff for our work session.
Stage of deed member announcements. Have any announcements?
I want to thank Mike for chairing and making sure that we were on time.
Most of the time.
What's your class policy?
Thank you, Jamie. I appreciate that.
You did a great job.
Thank you, Mike.
I have two quick announcements. One is the good work of Deeb, I think, well, came to fruition in a board hearing on Tuesday evening with the work on reducing the SWE fees. That was well received by the board, and they unanimously approved that. Formal proceedings, it needs to go into an actual board approval process, which will occur on Tuesday for the public or the official vote on it. So that will be finalized on Tuesday, and we set it in the document to have it effective January 1st. So that is on its way. And then finally, again, just as an announcement, actually was a news release today that we have five openings which will be occurring on the D board effective March 31st, or at least five terms expiring on March 31st. If I may so say, I think we have an excellent, strong, very capable, resourceful board here. So should you feel so inclined to reapply, we invite you to do that. But those members include, with terms expiring on March 31st, Mike Odrin, Andrew Gunther. You better. Steve Bacon, Don Hardy, and Jamie Housley. So just a heads up there. So the news release is out, and it went out today and is open until February the 17th.
Does Jamie's extra expire? Because he's an appointed position, isn't he?
Yes.
So I don't know if that one can technically expire.
I still own three.
Okay.
That closes on February 17th?
Yes.
It could be taken by somebody else.
Yeah, that's true.
Sent to the board.
I'll rest it.
just appoint somebody.
Jamie.
If you'd address that to Jennifer Clark.
Okay. All right. Any other announcements? Seeing none, we'll move on to Mr. Silverman's presentation on the homework charter.
Thank you. As a result of my visiting your group last month, in December or November, one of those meetings, the subject of the charter came up, and I raised my hand and said that if you wanted to talk about that, I volunteered to come and speak to any issues that you'd like to address. I can cover just a few. I think you know how we got here. I don't have to go much into the process. Board called for the election of freeholders, which happened in 2013. They produced a charter. Last year that went to the voters who approved the charter. And I think the most visible changes from the public's perspective is that we will be going from three commissioners to five council members. The citizens will have the power of initiative and referendum at the county level going forward, although there's a lot of debate about how effective that is. And the county executive or our county manager has a lot of formalized powers. There's actually been a separation of powers in an executive and legislative branch. And what we find right now is that we're just beginning that transition process to implement the charter as of January 1st, it became effective. What this has produced so far is a little bit of uncertainty as far as the impact. Uncertainty as to who is taking the lead on the transition. And maybe I can give you just an example of what's happening as we talk about specifically boards and commissions. And that might already be in your, a little bit of your understanding, because it's been in the newspaper about boards and commissions. There's already been some misunderstanding about what's happening actually in the office. Some people, somebody made a comment that people have interpreted it as meaning that the charter called for something illegal to be done. So let me clarify what has happened. One of the new responsibilities of the county manager will be the appointment of most boards and commission members. So as of January 1, naturally the county manager was saying, well, commissioners, I should be assuming responsibility for this board appointment that's coming up. But we haven't completed some of the research on that. So that if we go back to the charter, it specifies specifically, the county manager will appoint members of boards and commissions subject to the charter, interlocal agreement, or state law. So there are three boards specifically that are named in the charter. So everybody thought, well, those are not debatable. So that's the Planning Commission, the Board of Equalization, and the Historic Preservation Commission. Those are specifically enumerated. So everybody knew those were, but nobody had worked up a list and said, well, what does this state law clause mean? So it turns out that this one that the county manager was saying I should assume responsibility for, I started doing the research after he suggested that and found that there are several in state law that are listed out, and we just passed out this table here. Not secret, it's public information at this point. And this is just a table that lists out any RCWs that reference a board, any Clark County code that references a specific board, or there might be bylaws that exist for boards. So we identified the state laws that specifically said, and there's several different languages there, but the state law might specify that the county board of commissioners makes the appointment, or it might specify that the county legislative authority makes the appointment, or it might say the governing body. And so in those instances, we confirmed with the prosecuting attorney's office, those are ones that the charter is not overriding and specifically is referenced in the charter. So those boards and commissions at this point are going to stay just like they are where the board makes the appointment. The question is now how to handle the transition from the board to the county manager on the other ones. So my goal has been to get all the parties in agreement that this is the right starting point, and then help them to understand how the county manager is going to implement a process and involve them, because our county commissioners or council members still have the responsibility to confirm or reject any appointment from the county manager. So in a sense, they still get to look over his shoulder and have a say in who gets appointed to boards. But the county manager is the one that gets to sign on the dotted line saying you're being appointed. And this is relevant to you right now because five positions on this board are now up for consideration or reappointment. And the county manager will most likely be the one handling that process for you. He might decide to have interviews. He might decide to simply look and do a desk review and reappoint somebody that's been reapplied. He may choose, for efficiency's sake, to push responsibility for interviewing back to departments. That's up to him as far as I'm concerned, because the charter gives him that authority. But because it's a transition, it's one of those things where you have to have everybody on the same page, everybody kind of in agreement or comfortable with the direction we're going. So it's been a challenge to present that, because naturally when you're giving up power, or being it's perceived as giving up power on the part of the county commissioners, they want a slow-as-you-go approach and want it to be very thorough, understood, and we don't want to make mistakes or impact other working groups on the board. So that kind of shows, as an example, of what we are doing. This is going to be replicated in other areas. Another significant one is signing authority for contracts. That specifically transfers to the county manager, whereas it would have gone to the board for their approval previously. And there's no dollar amount specified in the charter, so our county manager will now be signing off on $6 million road projects or purchases of software, things like that. And so that's an adjustment that they will have to make. Greg mentioned the 10 a.m. Wednesday meeting, and I believe the format for that will be more of a county manager briefing. So this idea of the county manager signing off on a $6 million contract, this might be a forum where he has the authority to sign it, but he will probably be briefing the manager or the counselors on the significant actions that he's taking, just so they're informed and in the loop. And I don't see it replacing work sessions necessarily. Work sessions would probably happen in addition to that meeting. I see it more of a county manager briefing the counselors specifically meeting. So those are just a couple of examples of things going forward, but I think the process will be slow, deliberate, non-disruptive for the rest of the county. It's pretty much just the Board of Commissioners' office reacclimating themselves to a different balance of how things get signed off in that office. So I hope that's a good overview to start. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to have them.
Who's going to be signing final plans?
That's a good question.
Go ahead. It would be email. Commissioners, by our
state law.
So, unfortunately, actually. No offense, but we thought we could save some time, and right. We still might be able to get into that.
Gotcha.
Okay. Yeah. It'd be nice if the county is pretty routine. It'd be nice if the manager could sign that. Mm-hmm.
So, again, that's one of those things that you always have to take into consideration when we decide to move the responsibility. Everybody gets eyeballs on it and checks it from all perspectives. Make sure we're doing it.
Public comment, which was always a big thing on Tuesdays, has been a big thing. When's that going to be? Is that still going to be on Tuesdays?
They will still have Tuesday night hearings for the board. I imagine the agendas will be a little bit shorter than they have been in the past, especially when they look at the consent agenda items that have previously been on there.
So that's still the appropriate time for
that's still
anyone to come in.
They will still have a Wednesday board hiring meeting at this point. And in addition, they'll have a county manager briefing on Wednesday morning.
Does the county manager take public comment?
That's something that they're actually looking into. What actions might he take that need to be done at a public open meeting? He needs to investigate that and verify that.
On the signing of contracts, if there's an RFP that the county issues, so the county manager then will have final authority on the approval of that. The Board of Commissioners will not need to, there'll be a selection process, and once that's done, the commissioners, will they not need to approve?
I think the way it will happen going forward is the commissioners will have, still have oversight of the budget, but if something is outlined in the budget, headcount, road projects, if they are already in the budget and accounted for, it looks like the county manager will be assuming responsibility to sign the contract.
When will the council go to 5 members?
Okay, very good question. So this year, this fall, you'll have 2 additional elections. One will be for the elector or councilor that will be elected countywide, and one will be in the now vacant district, which is Northwest Clark County. So it's Isabel, Salmon Creek, Richfield, and Center. So those will both be on the ballot this fall. So I think several people have already notified their intention to run. Ann Rivers, Tom Milkey have said they were interested in running in the county-wide position. That's another significant change too. We just elected a chair of the commission, which has been rotated among the members for the last, it's been a matter of practice, but it's an elected position by the board. That is going to be formalized, and the person that is elected countywide will be the permanent chair of the council going forward, so there will be no more rotation of that position.
So they'll be sworn in probably January, but they'll take office.
Take office in January. Any other questions?
All right. Well, thank you for that update. Move on to item three, final plat process improvement updates.
Okay. So in the back of your packets, I believe, thank you for...
You're welcome.
Copies of the final plat working group report. So this takes off from August, I think the last meeting, that there was already, before I came on board, there was already a subcommittee or working group established in August 2013. And so we reconvened back in September and then again in December to take a look at where we could build in efficiencies into the final plat process and figure out ways to shorten the process, make it simpler. And so we had two really productive meetings, and Chuck and Diana are here, and Marty, and they've been great. I think we've managed to shave off quite a bit of time, actually, in the process. The report is pretty self-explanatory, but just kind of going through some of the highlights. The first section kind of gives you the areas that we identified for improvement, and then the solutions that we've either discussed or we've implemented. Of course, emphasizing good communication was, and that's just kind of an ongoing thing. Improving community development's access to plotters and scanners. We think at some point it might be a good idea for community development to get their own plotter and scanner, but they're able to share now with engineering. Right? Is that the, so right now that isn't a big issue. I think that as we distribute these more electronically, a lot of people still want to do it on paper, but as we turn to using it, the electronic as the medium to distribute the plats and things like that, probably we'd have to relook at that. Being able to turn in plats the same day for next day appointments and setting up that process. Right now what we've got in place is for items that, and you guys jump in when if I state something wrong, it is kind of a complex process, but for items that are non-fee based, by the end of January, whoever is working with the plat, turning in the plats and things like that, should be able to do it in a walk-in basis. And part of that end of January date is one thing that was identified in here, and it was actually a big item, was to have a dedicated staff person to handle the plat, be the point person for the plats. And so Angie is going to be, she's not here, so Angie's going to be the dedicated, what is her last name? I'm sorry, Merrill. Angie Merrill is going to be the dedicated plat person. So way back when, there was, I don't know how many years ago, but there was a dedicated plat person, and everything ran really smoothly because she took ownership of the plats. And, there's all kinds of, anyone who's gone through the plat process, there's all kinds of moving parts. And Diana's been great at dealing with that. In engineering, she kind of keeps that all on track in terms of tracking people down, not only in engineering, but in planning and outside agencies. So a big improvement, I think, is going to be Andy's training right now, and is going to be doing it full-time, right? So Marty, the plats.
She already moved Angie out of the permit center. She only comes back up when we're super busy. So predominantly she is already handling all the still fully complete and in the final class as well.
So that's going to be that'll be a big help to have her take ownership of that. For lack of a better word, she'll take ownership of that. It'll be a one point person for people to go and be able to submit things and be able to, if there's things that are needed, and she'll kind of run it like Diana's been kind of helping out in engineering. As part of that, by the end of January, hopefully she'll be in a position where she can accept non-fee based materials and items and things like that on a same day basis. And I think after that, we would continue to look at this kind of an auditor's issue. Go ahead, Chuck. Yeah.
And sorry, just to clarify, the non-fee-based stuff would be able to be accepted right at the front counter by the OA staff. They wouldn't have to see Angie. It's the fee-based stuff that would require Angie, because you have to create the receipt, because the cashiers can't do that function by auditor standards.
Then that's good clarification. And so for the fee-based, she's still going to work to try to get it where it's maybe same day if it's possible.
Correct. Working directly with her, so she'll be able to do that same day. And then the non-fee, we're in the process right now of training that front on the staff.
That's so they know that they're on the floor.
Okay. You know, with Andy coming on board, one of the things that we emphasized to the working group was, again, the with the way Platt's going through the final Platt process, kind of that multi-layered, the things, the fact that there's a lot of moving parts that are happening all at once. And in the past, sometimes what's happened is there'll be a component that is missing on a Platt, and then the whole Platt process will just stop until that component's received. So, you know, Angie hopefully is going to be running this where she can, you know, make sure everything keeps moving to the extent that it can. If there's additional information that needs to be submitted, so everything doesn't come to a halt. Explore examples of where problems have been experienced on minor issues and conflicts. That had to do with the post-decision reviews and whether we wanted to look at a code change in the post-decision review process to allow Marty to be able to make some minor changes and things like that. It turns out that Marty kind of does have that authority and does exercise it when he feels that it's appropriate. And right now we don't think that we need a code change to do that. One thing that's there, and I put a question mark, one thing that is, there is the potential for applicants to understand that they may be able to kind of build in and out, and Jamie was the one that suggested it, in certain conditions with the hearing examiner, where the hearing examiner might be able to give Marty more authority beyond just really minor changes, so that you don't have to go through a post-decision review process if you have an issue that may or may not be able to be worked out through Marty. So, and anyone's going to do that process, you know, if you can't convince Marty that it's a minor clarification or something like that, and you have to go through a post-decision review, it's a pain. So, so right now we're kind of leaving it as it is. But I guess some education that you can build those into your, and I don't know if you want to speak to that, building out into the hearing examiner's decision that says, you know, this can be reviewed by Marty or changed.
Yeah, I mean, I guess like the best example would be the classic ball that is there when the development application goes through, but then decides to fly away somewhere else and no longer exists, and yet you still have a huge limitation on that area, and giving him some more flexibility with just issues like that. That's the most extreme example, but there might be others that are there.
So, having simple change like having the Board of County Commissioners sign the plat, the hearing when they actually adopt it, sign it contemporaneously with that, and the board is doing that, as my understanding. So that's helped. That shaves off maybe a day, maybe two, so you don't have to chase the commissioners around and try to get their signature. It's been placed right on the plat down there, whoever the chair is, and hopefully that'll be easy with a permanent chair. That is one thing we looked at in our last meeting was, our interpretation anyway, and obviously you need to look at it, or you already have, is that the RCWs requires the board to sign those. We were thinking that the county manager might be able to sign them and might be able to move those here quicker. But, working on the process to shorten the timing to load the plat system after reporting, that's a big one where we potentially save quite a good amount of time. In that Chuck will accept down at the permit center, he'll accept the paper plat to start processing with the health department's signature on it, so that we know that it's the right and accurate paper plat to start processing building permits. So he'll start processing building permits on a plat while the plat's going through the whole process of getting recorded and uploaded in the GIS and all. So that probably helps anyone who's running a plat through to, you know, save up to a couple weeks. Because your permits are going to be ready on your first building, first building envelopes, and will be ready, I guess, right after they are uploaded to GIS. Is that when we're
correct? GIS does generally allow 2 to 3 business days for them to get everything uploaded. Depending on what time, saying around 4 days. But as soon as that's uploaded, we're able to shift the parcel number to be correct address in our permitting system, and the permit will be ready to issue. We've been testing it. We've tested on a couple of subdivisions now. One didn't go so well. The other one went pretty well. So we're still kind of trying to test it. So I'm asking people as they're getting ready to do, and like working with Angie when she calls for Mylar, the idea is she'll be asking the clients as well at that time, do you have builders ready, bring us a paper copy as well, and I'll put that in the loop. So my goal is, I'm hoping by second quarter that's a standard norm in what we do every time.
So this is all really, really good stuff for anyone who's running plats through or has run plats through in the past. Another part of that that you kind of touched on was the reviewing of the plat itself. And what our goal was to figure out whether we could kind of do the as-bills on a paper review. And what we've come up with is that engineering can review the first set on paper. The second set can be reviewed on paper, but they'll be stamped. They'll be the copy that's stamped by the building inspector, the as-bills that are stamped by the building inspector. But then at that point, you don't, and you got to correct me if I got this wrong, but you don't have to resubmit to engineering on Mylar and wait for engineering to call for Mylar. And you can call for Mylar and you can get Mylar ready to go ahead of time. So this, you know, a lot of these things depend on, I mean, it's a partnership between whoever's running the plat through and the county to try to get everything in a row. But if everything is in a row, we should be able to save a fair amount of time there. Someone brought up about the inspectors signing off on a punch list. We have come up with a process, and the inspectors are signing off so that you know you have a final punch list. And I guess this is where there's, again, it's a two-way street on the emphasizing and using templates for legal documents, because that's another, Chris Horn is just absolutely, everyone in this room I think knows that, and it's just overloaded. And so, for instance, when he gets CC&Rs that he has to review, and he's got a bunch of covenants stuck in the CC&Rs, and that's why he has to review the CC&Rs, he has to review them in the entirety. So one thought is to let your clients know and just communicate out that take the covenants out of the CC&R so that Chris doesn't have to review the CC&Rs and do covenants separately. And then also working on trying to get templates that can be used by the county, more templates get used by the county and by developers to cover a lot of these covenants that are, the problem is we've got to figure out a way to make sure they're read-only, kind of the PDF fill-in kind of thing, so that people can't change what's in there and that everyone's comfortable with them, kind of like bonds are done. You can go off and do the bond forms. So that same type of thing for a lot of commonly used covenants and things like that. So that the point again being that if you can keep it out of Chris Horn's hands and not just because of his workload, the less he has to cover, the better off everyone is in terms of timing. So the county is looking at developing more templates and figuring out a way to feel comfortable with them, that they're read-only and that the people won't go in and change the wording.
You can make the standard covenants and number them, letter them, whatever, and then your CC&Rs just address what the standard covenant A.
Right, and the CC&Rs you reference it.
And G or whatever, you could just reference the ones that are standardized and in county policy or code, whichever it would have to be.
Exactly, and that's what the CC&Rs can still reference the covenant, and Chris wouldn't have to review the CC&Rs. So that's exactly what the goal is. So. Another big one, though, and again, it's a communication one, is that maintenance bonds can be pursued basically out the construction bids, unless the county or whoever feels that there's going to be some big changes. So you can start pushing your maintenance bonds, because bonds can take several weeks or more, depending upon your bonding company and the process, but front-loading that. So altogether, we managed to, you know, most of these things are in place now, we're being looked at. I think we managed to, you know, make the process a lot more efficient and really just kind of, I mean, it already was efficient, but just kind of look at where we can improve it. I think having a dedicated staff member is going to be a huge help as that flat load ramps up, which it already is. I guess I would recommend a 6-month follow-up or something to kind of see that some of these things, how this is going again, and just take a look at this again halfway through the year. There were a couple of things that came up at the last meeting. And even the meeting before that, you know, some of the outside agencies affect our timing. And if we can deal with trying to get them to realize that, you know, that's a very stressful time for everyone when you're trying to run a plat through. You know, Marty brought up that the charter, there may be a way to see if we can shorten the processing time, even if if it is with the Board of County Commissioners, if we can take that 2 weeks and bring it down to a week or something, there may be a way to shave some time off there. So there's still some other things to look at and explore, and I guess I'd suggest that maybe we kind of take a look at it on a biannual basis or something like that. And just, this is a bit, it's a, you know, when plats, it's kind of where the rubber hits the road when you're, and if you're getting delayed several months out on a plat and trying to get it through a process is really frustrating. It gets very stressful, not only for the county, but on the public side as well. So, I don't know if there are any questions.
Yeah. Have you guys talked about any, once you've kind of got these procedures, policies worked out, is there going to be any public outreach, training, introduction seminar that kind of that can be opened up to the development community so that you can kind of fill them in on the new process? I know that, you know, people have been stuck in the same process all along, or is staff going to be educating people along the way as they come in, or should there be like a seminar, the new final plat process seminar, sit down for 45 minutes, walk, you know, members from the development community, firms, things like that through this so that they understand what it was in the past and what's going to be in the future, so that we know. Otherwise, I think you're going to have a bunch of stumbling around for people outside of this group and outside of the shareholders group that don't
know. Yeah, that's a good question. So we had a lot of title people involved. I don't know what percentage of the plats are run through by, you know, say the public versus title companies. So we had some of the major stakeholders in terms of people that actually run the plats through the county on the committee. But I think some form of communication, I don't know what it would take. That's something.
There is a trifold flyer or something like that. And it'll be good that, but I don't know if everybody in the title community is aware of this. Do you have representatives from all the title companies, and are they then passing that information along to everybody else in their title companies?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Wants to host that?
No.
That's a good question. I mean, I'm not sure if anyone's got any thoughts on that, but it's, you know, there's a lot of this where it is a two-way street, where it's the county often is waiting for stuff from us,
right,
you know, to move it forward, or if a maintenance bond, if they didn't realize the maintenance bond can be done pretty much before construction starts, or right when construction starts, and not at the end of the process, things like that. So, I don't know if you have any thoughts, or you guys have any thoughts on how to communicate that out. We can look at that, talk about it out.
I haven't thought outside that of the.
No, that's fine. But
you bring up a valid point, so I made the note, because absolutely, I definitely plan the word of mouth as far as like as we shift things along the way in the baby steps. But at the end, absolutely.
Even if it's email, mass email, goes out. What the differences are, the old way, the new way, so that they can see a comparison between the two, and people can kind of get in their minds the new process, new procedures, the new players.
Yep, absolutely.
Got it.
Yeah,
good idea. Okay, we'll take a look at that. Any other?
One comment from one of the outside agencies. I don't know whether we're one of the ones that hold things up, but.
No, I think we can go ahead.
I do, I mean, I can see how it would, because, you know, when we get the final plats in, we're sitting there reviewing them for, you know, did the lots look like they did on the plans, or the, you know, are there easements shown, blah, 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 you know, stuff like that. It might be something just for the development community and the engineers and surveyors and stuff to think about getting us copies of the preliminary plat independently of the final plat process. We could do away with 95% of the comments that we would have on any plats just by getting a look at one beforehand. Because it's stuff that we already know is supposed to be there. By the time we're looking at plans, we know what's supposed to be on the plat for us.
Are you talking about a preliminary plat, the one that goes through the hearing, or the preliminary final plat?
Well, you know, it would be in the middle of the process, the planning, you know, when the plans are done and
after
we...
the hearing.
Because, you know, we get the little mini copy in the DNS and stuff like that, that but 9 times out of 10, that's not what the final lot layout looks like anyway. So we want something that's at that, you know, but we don't have to wait necessarily until the as-builts are done for us to see the plat and know that, hey, the easements aren't shown or something look, you know, it, this doesn't look like the plans that we approve type of comments, which is what we, those are the only comments we really ever have from our side anyways. And I don't know what other agencies have for comments, but right. getting the other agencies involved earlier, not necessarily in an official review, but in a preliminary review might save some of that headache in the end, you know, because then we get a copy of the final plat. We've already addressed most of the minor stuff that, or major stuff, I guess, and there might be a few minor comments that are easier to deal with.
Back to the earlier question that Mike was asking. If we can rely on, you know, word of mouth and email exchanges and the like as we go through a transition, once we've kind of moved away from transition to, okay, we can clearly identify the old way and then crosswalk to the new way, that when we have that fully baked, we could probably have a few kind of meet and greet tutorials when the permit center closes to the public at 3 or 3:30 and then invite people in from title and other professional firms and say, here's how we'd like to kind of see this happen from here on out. But I don't want to obligate a bunch of people with incremental improvements. I'd rather say, well, we've made these incremental improvements and now we've got something more fully baked to share with the world. I don't know how long that might take. Maybe Chuck will give me a bad look or not. maybe a couple months, I don't know.
I feel honestly in where Andy is right now, I mean, she is far, and not that I don't have all the faith in the world in Andy taking on this role, but she is much further along in where I thought she would be in her training, especially with all the final classes that are still coming in. Between her work and training with Diana as well as Terry, what she's been able to do is take the good of both to kind of create her own process to make it that much better when people are coming in. So she's still working closely with Diana more often and stuff, but she's much further along as far as the training where I thought she'd be in training. So we are moving this way faster than I anticipated we would be. So,
well, if the board is okay with it, if we can just kind of keep it as a item to regroup again in 6 months or something like that. But staff has been, it was great. It was a pleasure to actually make a difference, you know, where you can actually see that you've actually taken some time off and staff is great to work with. So, you know, it's been a fun one.
So you're thinking of when we do an update, would that be best led by you or maybe by Chuck and Diana?
It could be either one. I was thinking the subgroup might get together, you know, in 6 months or just follow through on where all this is going, and then whoever, you know, anyone can give the presentation. So.
I nominate you.
What's that?
I nominate you. Okay,
hey, so.
Jeff is passionate about this.
I know.
So, Jeff, in your mind, this will expedite the process. It won't take any less staff time. The staff time is just allocated.
I don't think it'll take any less
or
staff
more
time, although renewed. What's that?
Or less or more.
And it won't take more. I think this is, it may even take less if it's run, because it's looking for little efficiencies that actually kind of add up. You know, so if for instance, I mean, low, if staff doesn't have to chase the commissioners around for a final plat, for instance.
And that's happened.
Yeah, and it does happen. So there's just, and creating communication. Chris Horn, for instance, if he doesn't have to get all the legal, because we've got, you know, so there's most of it actually on lower staff time, and it creates, I mean, it really should be a matter of weeks. If everyone follows the system, it should be able to front load, so you know, should be paring down this process, you know, shortening it by a few weeks at least, yeah. if not more. So
we got one step in here that might shorten it 11 to 14 days.
Yeah, that's why I put that in there, because that was fairly significant. And there's others in there that are the day here, day there, but you know, all told it could add up to, you know, 3 weeks or more. The new system that's coming in, Marty mentioned, ought to, you know, we'll see. But and that's why it's under follow-up, but that ought to improve communication. A lot of it's communication, so.
It truly is, as you're saying. It's a matter of, I think staff time's probably going to be the same. I really do, but I think it's how we allocated their time. We're not linear. We're trying to do this simultaneously. But right now, okay, final plat. Okay, now we get the plat. Now we work it up. Now we take in a building permit. Where we're saying, okay, we bring in the final plat. We're going to start with that, doing our initial supporting review, the permit execution, get ready for the chance. Bring in the permits, those are all getting reviewed at the same time you're waiting for the council to sign off, and then GIS to upload everything to the database. So permits are out the same day that it happens.
Does the county still have a non-home permit option? So you can actually get a permit before your plat's recorded?
You can do it. You can, depends on how you do it. You can do a performance bond, and it's a recorded plat. You can get one model home per 20 more.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, great. Thanks for the update. I'll plan to follow up with you maybe in July.
That sounds good.
Good job,
yeah. Oh, looking forward to it. Yeah, it's a pleasure.
So moving on to item four, Jamie.
I don't have much of an update this month. Unfortunately, the holidays got in my way today. My own party, draft of the code. So I will make that a priority as I believe that Marty and Chuck are coming into the BIA on Monday. So I'll hand deliver a copy of that, and maybe we can bring that back to some time for February.
Okay.
Well, when people aren't prepared, it makes it feel simple.
All right, Marty, code amendments to the home business North Valley Zone.
So, actually, I'm glad Peter's here because he can speak to one more so than the other. And I don't know if we actually have anything to share with you, but it's very simple, very straightforward. There are two amendments going to the Planning Commission in a week. One relates to our home business ordinance, and the other relates to our multifamily zones. The first is the home business ordinance. We have, you know, urban and rural, major and minor, and there's been interest in allowing more employment to occur in home businesses. So currently we have a maximum number of employees in a home business. I believe the proposal is to eliminate that maximum number. A couple things will, I believe, temper how many people could be employed on a site. One has to do with occupancy load of any buildings, and the second would be the activity area of the site. There's a certain amount, certain percentage of activity area, for example, in a rural area. So those two things will be somewhat drivers to the number of employees you have on the site. So Peter can speak more to that if you have questions. The multifamily zone code amendment is something that for the better part of last year, maybe even longer, the Board of County Commissioners at the time were looking at final plats. There were some concerns and some wavering support on these small lot subdivisions in multifamily zones that result in single-family detached housing. The majority of the commissioners at the time were not wildly supportive of that option moving forward. So they looked at, they asked staff to look at a code amendment that would no longer permit single-family detached dwelling units on in the multifamily zones. A couple of thoughts that I had during the conversation earlier on was that in the higher density zones, I think MF 30 and 43 and whatever, certainly, you know, those are meant for high density apartment style, you know, developments. The lower end of the multifamily zones, when you get into R12 and 18, you know, it's more market sensitive. But the board is looking at a code amendment to no longer allow single family detached dwellings in these zones. So those are going to be presented to the planning commission next week and
work session.
Work session and then hearing on the hearing is the 22nd. Well, I know that the work session is, the work session is next week, but I thought it was work session followed immediately by the planning commission hearing.
We're showing it tonight.
The 15th.
In the hearing next week.
That's Jen Zola, because he's taking it to the commission work session tonight when he's in the hearing.
Question, please. The HOC piece.
Home occupation, home business. Yeah.
So that is allowed zone, but regardless of zone, the idea is that you get home occupation in residentially zoned areas.
Yes.
Not that you mentioned one person. That I have concerns about that in the sense that the average buyer, the average resident, thinks they're buying in a residential area, and then a trucking company opens up next door.
With 25 employees.
What do I know about this? Very little, other than
legitimate concern. Maybe I can speak to that. The idea of removing the employee number is not to create a wild west. They can do whatever they want to, but there are three types of businesses addressed. One are exempt businesses because they're so small, you know, the accountant running an office. There's a minor business and a major business. And this proposes under the major business, which you have to come through, get reviewed, get a permit for, that we just not consider the employee number as a criteria. So there was a table that, so if you can picture a 5 or 10 acre lot, there was a table that expressed how many employees you could have, and it was 4 or maybe it was 6 for 10 acres. And what this does is just eliminate that as a criteria. So if you want to have 5 employees instead of 4, you don't have to pay extra to get a variance. So, and you maybe have more that come intermittently. There are also several other criterias in the ordinance that limit the size and scope of your business, and we're not touching any of the screening or compensatory requirements of having a business. So if you can imagine, they're still limited on the size of their building, the activity area, which they might pave a work area or something for parking, whatever, that's still limited in the code. It's only the one detail of how many employees you have on site that move as a consideration. Does that make sense?
The words do. I'm not sure that I agree with the liberalization of the system. I see myself sitting at the end of a private road on a 5-acre lot, and there's 3 other lots in front of me, and conceivably there could be 3 businesses there. And I bought a 5-acre parcel in a residential zoned area.
But there could be 3 businesses there now, and they still have to get a permit, and they're limited in size and scope.
I mean, it's one thing to buy after the fact. It's another to buy the 5-acre parcel, and then these guys, after the fact, open businesses. I just think
that's the way I think it is now. What they're saying is that they're no longer limited, not only what the threshold or the limit, the upper limit is for the number of employees that they can have. Sounds like, you know, is there any limit on the number of employees?
Well, right now there's a specified number of limits. So if I had 5 acres and I lived next to you, I could have a business. I'd have to get a permit. I could have 4 employees there. They would limit the size of the building, the space I could use for that business. They would limit the size of the ground I could develop for parking or other activity out there if I had a sawmill or whatever the case may be. So all those limits are still in place, or are proposed to remain in place in the ordinance. So they'd still have to get a permit. With major businesses, there are screening requirements so that your neighbors don't have to see your activity area. Those all remain in place.
But then the number of employees.
That's the number that goes away. So we have between 2.5 and 5, 5 and 7.5, 7.5 and 10, 10 and 15, 15 to 20, and greater than 20. Mm-hmm. Rural major home business. So there are all these standards, and the maximum number of non-resident employees is 4 up to the 10 acres, and then over 10 acres is 6 non-resident employees.
So something precipitated us. There always is something. Can you tell us the backstory? Because that might help us figure out why.
Well, there are some constituents that came to the commissioners and presented a couple scenarios. One of them might be where you don't have a bunch of employees on site, but occasionally you have more than 4 employees employed by your business, but they work off site and they come to your office intermittently. Technically, you're in violation because you have more than 4 employees on a 5-acre lot, even though they might come there once a day or once every other day. Your business.
What kind of businesses are they?
It's like a landscaping or a plumbing company or something like that.
Yeah. But if you're living next to, right now, as I said, the size of the lot, if you're running that on a 1-acre parcel that's underdeveloped in the city, you're running your business out of there. The idea is that those businesses are in industrial zones. They're not even allowed in line commercial zones. So I think it's changed recently, but I mean, because of the screening required, they try to separate them from residential zones.
And that's kind of what I was going to ask about is, if the employee number is going away, are there design parameters for on-site parking requirements and those kinds of things that are addressing that?
Yeah, see, there's still on-site parking requirement in the code. There's still screening requirements. There's still activity area limitations. So we wanted to consider, if we do away with the employee limitation, will those other considerations limit the size and scope of what you can do?
And are these just for rural areas, or if you have a 10,000 square foot lot and you live in the county, you could end up with a business with 6 employees next to you?
I think I originally asked Gordy to write it up as only the rural one major businesses, but I think the way you wrote it up, it applies to urban or rural major businesses. And I didn't know we'd be discussing it, or I could actually brought the code.
It's the major,
the rural
major.
What kind of reviews do these go through? I mean, I'm kind of keying off of Ott's comment about, you know, he lives at the end of a private road and all of a sudden the neighbors can get unlimited number of employees. But, you know, I know, me living on a private road, if all of a sudden my neighbors decided to open up a business, I really wouldn't care, but then all of a sudden they're beating on my private road that I have to pay to, that maintain.
Type two,
there's existing.
Yeah.
Hmm?
Type two. So you get notice and an opportunity to appeal the decision.
It's going to be easier to open a business in a residential zone than a commercial business.
Directly.
For an industrial, something that's normally required in light industrial, like that. I have a client right now who's going to love this. he has a landscape company.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's looking for a property. He bought a property, it's commercially zoned. He's told he can't put it there because it's too high of an impact. And he has probably something like this, but he can run it out of his house so he doesn't have to, buy this industrial parcel that he's looking at because that's the only place it's really allowed.
You know what bothers me more than this? And maybe I'm totally off base here, but I thought this is the reason this board existed. This is the first time I've heard of this.
Right now. And it's already going to PC.
Yeah.
Today.
I feel disenfranchised in the sense of a member of this board. And if that's the way it's going to be run, I'm not interested.
I agree. The second one's kind of like that, too.
The second one, I think, is even bigger.
Yeah,
we're going to get to that. I just spoke here. I was looking at the code, like you just proposed, and it does include the urban major home businesses as well, as with right now.
So urban,
urban and rural.
Major.
Major.
Yeah, the idea of a home business is it is kind of, you know, so you can get started, you know, and it's a seat, basically. And then once they get to a certain size, they really need to go to the appropriate zone. So if it's a landscape company and you're operating at your house and you hate seeing all those trucks there, you have to move to the appropriate zone for that business.
So if the business is going to expand past, say, yeah, you know, a couple of trucks and trailers.
Even my company, I can technically run that out of my house. I have all my employees open in my garage and my basement. And I don't think neighbors appreciate it very much.
But there would be nothing they could do about it.
Right.
You can show up with me. I think you probably know this, but the impacts to the neighbors are a lot greater. I mean, at 4 to 6 employees, or even 10 or 12 employees, the impacts to the neighbors aren't generally that bad, but you start getting into unlimited. Mm-hmm. You remove the limits, and all of a sudden, you've got a lot more, especially on the rural 5 and 10 acre parcels. Most of those are going to be on the private road, you know, the 5 acre at least, you're going to be on the private roads where you're dealing with other issues than just noise or visual. You're dealing with actual impacts to your mobility.
And private roads are addressed in the ordinance, so they are required to have, if they're going to open a business, they are required to have an agreement with the other neighbors to mitigate those impacts, aren't they?
If they have
So, Pete, you know, in a broader sense, mm-hmm. how the concurrence of board, council board,
whatever you like, board or
council, using this development engineering advisory board and the role that this board would play advising them?
I think if you have an opinion on it, they would like to hear it. So what happened on this was, it was brought to their attention, the option was discussed, it was handed off to Gordy, planning staff to have to review it and produce that, and I assume it's going to the planning commission because of him. Mm-hmm. If it needs to come to here, or maybe that should come to here, then I think that's part of the process that we need to clarify for staff and the commissioners. I don't think there was an intention to skip this board.
We didn't have anything in our packet ahead of time for this, did we?
Nope.
I saw it. Because I got the thing for the planning commission, then there was also a DNS that came up. So we looked at it through that, and I was aware that it was coming and did a little research in advance.
Mm-hmm. But this was actually placed on the agenda by you then, right? Or who?
No, I think it was placed by Jan.
Kind of taking this over. And so I realized that I probably didn't get this to engineering in a timely fashion. So this is the planning commission report, report to the planning commission. It's got the text changes in there.
So if we turn to the second item.
Yes. Sorry about the next one.
Yeah, sorry about the next one. I know that Eric submitted comments and planning commission members.
It wasn't formally, but I might submit it formally before the hearing. Because today's work session, I just brought it to someone's attention, so they wanted to make sure they understood the significance of it. And, you know, to kind of hit him to appears. But the first major issue, this is a multifamily, what's called.
Before you start,
yes.
Interrupt. I'm looking at county code here. In this section, 4220.020, I see nothing in there that says multifamily.
That was my first point.
No.
That's where I was going with it. And in my comment, I said these zones are being referred to as multifamily zones. These are not multifamily zones. They are R zones, residential, and it's medium and high density. And there's a difference between medium and high density. Because you look at the size lots, this is an essential zone for affordable housing in Clark County. there's a lot prices in the product. I kind of put a little example. This is the type of product I think is being encouraged in R18 zone. This is a narrow lot, but I think it's well done. This is a critical entry-level housing step that's worth, it tends to appreciate over time. This is what it's actually forcing it into. These are neighboring developments. By the way, the average resale on something like this is probably $170,000 to $180,000. This is about $230,000. And I kind of asked the question, what do you want in your neighborhood? The development was going in. What would you rather have? And what's the higher impact on the neighborhood? And they're the same exact zone, built about a similar time, within a few years of each other. And it's an R18. This is R18.
So those lot sizes, Eric, what are the differences between those lot sizes that you...
These here are about 8 feet wider than there. I tried to get the best example I could find of a similar size that were just attached or detached. They both meet the density in the code, and they're both provided for in the zone. I think what's happening here is an overreaction. I think it's well-intentioned, because I've seen some stuff that's happened recently, and what it was, someone bought a multifamily thing, and they tried to post-decision review, and they tried to stick a very, very narrow product, up to 17 feet wide on a product. And you know, people are looking at it, and they don't like it. So I see this as potentially an overreaction. And what they're doing is saying, we're just not going to allow a single-family detached. But the adverse impact is worse than probably the solution. The solution's worse than the original concern. I think there's a better way to handle it. If they do want to address that, what they could do is simply change the minimum lot width for a single-family detached. But let's not throw the baby out the back. So that's in a nutshell. That's what I think is happening. And I could be wrong. I think it's well-intentioned. I think there's some developments out there that went through that they didn't like the look of, and they're saying, well, we'll just want a lot of the young. But it's important. And it's also misleading to think this is a multifamily. Our 18, 22, or our 12, especially 12,
12, 12, 12
most of the time, 12 to 18 develops into detached single family. Yeah, 12 and 18 do. 22 is really an in between.
Very important for your.
Those are high density. Those should not be single-family detached.
One of the nice things about the flexibility of those zones,
I'd like to see.
When we take away something like that, it doesn't allow us to see what the market wants to do, because it dictates that you cannot put detached or homes in those zones. So we there are a lot of builders out there that specialize in these narrow lots. I mean, I'd be a little concerned that that's what we have to do to put a number on it. But I agree with Eric, just to throw it out. The attach, I think, attracts more investors than it does first time home buyers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the detach is something that, like you said, is where I'm afraid that, it's very hard to put a 6,000 square foot lot on the ground in an affordable manner and build an affordable home and actually be a first time. I was just having a lot of conversation with someone today on that. I'd say, a regular 6,000 square foot lot is almost impossible, I think, to build an affordable home these days. Put it on the ground and sell it to a home builder and put it, get a home that is sub, 300. It depends on what you want to say is affordable. But my concern is that it takes away that flexibility. And then the types of builders that are doing that may be forced to pay 6,000 square foot zone type prices. I mean, it's just good. It's got a cascade of that.
So Jeff, is that like a 4,000 that works then versus 6? What's the magic square footage? I mean, is it like 4,000 that works and 6 doesn't? Or what's the difference
three
on that?
3 to 4, I think. 3,500 works, I think. I don't know if you've ever built. I haven't done that type of product.
What type of product are you looking at?
Well, the size of lot, you're wondering
the
size of lots.
Yeah, like the row house. The row
so
house.
So this is an example right here. This exact floor plan that is in this picture here.
Yep.
And it is a very livable plan, and it is 24 feet wide. And it's a very popular plan. Anywhere I've seen it, 22 to
what?
It is 32 wide. Yeah.
By 80 or 90.
Yeah, by 80 or 90. And it's a popular plan, and it provides that mention of options. Really, people need. They need that to step up, because not everyone's going to come out and be able to afford a $300,000 home. We need product in the 200s and the low 200s, and that's what this zone provides right now. It gives people a chance to start building equity in the home that appreciates. And when you're forcing them into attach, that's what it does. And there's a place for this. I would hate to see this knock out as well, but people should have a choice. And if you look at the comp sales for attached and detached, I would usually kind of my rule of thumb is this is worth $1,000 less than this product right here because it hit right off on your comp sales for attached and detached. So, and they don't appreciate as fast. So your cost of construction is almost the same. Your, what you get for it at the end of the day is not.
It just it seems like globally we're doing the comp plan update on a global scale, and there's a diversity of housing that's really supposed to be looked at, and it seems like smaller lot sizes would be appropriate, I mean, in that mix.
So smaller lot sizes, you'd just be forced into attached instead of having a choice between attached and detached.
I think that product, though, that detached, smaller scale product seems like it's reasonable, I mean, in that providing that variety.
Well, that's what people want right now. I mean, we've had a lot of townhouse developments that have, you know, started out as townhouses, you know, two, three, four plexes, and they got a few of them built, and the economy tanked, and now they come back and they can't sell attached housing, so they're going in and putting in the detached.
Yep.
You know, otherwise these things are just sitting fallow; they're not developing out because nobody wants the attached housing right now.
So here's a potential compromise, and this is what I want to kind of throw out for the board, for this group's consideration as a possible recommendation. I think we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater here, and it's a product that I think is desirable and is a need for in Clark County. I think the real problem is right now the minimum lot width is 25 feet for a detached single family. But what that allows is that allows a unit 17 feet wide. If the board has a real concern about these extremely narrow product, why don't we change that? So instead of saying the house is 17 feet wide, which there's a big difference, and I've done a lot of projects in the zone, I've seen these 17s. They're popular in Portland, there's a place for them, but they might not be Clark County. And if the board has a strong feeling about it, let's address that concern, not throw everything out. So from the projects we've done, I've seen very successful projects in the size of, you know, 20 feet to, you know, between 28 feet and 38 feet wide lots. So instead of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, let's change the 25 to 28. And that basically what that says is your home has to be 20 foot wide and it's going to be detached. Otherwise, you go with the cache. And at 20 foot wide, it's very livable. I've seen some great plans at 20 foot wide. I prefer a little bit wider myself, but you know, I don't think we should regulate preference. I think we should give those options. So that's my suggestion.
If someone's buying them, someone likes them. I mean, that's why I worry about taking it away from the market. You know, when we mandate these things and say thou shall not,
right,
take away all flexibility and
you're forcing the market.
You're forcing the market.
Yeah. Why not let the market dictate what is being built? I mean, there's got to be regulations, but if people want 20 foot wide houses or 24 foot wide houses, why is the county? I guess I don't know. I don't understand that.
Especially if attached is allowed. I mean, my thought is if I want start as a starter home. I mean, yeah, it's narrow, but I think the market's going to come back, and those probably are going to even be more desired based on the increase in prices.
So are we aiming towards a recommendation? I would like to make a recommendation. I think it's something we've heard the Planning Commission tonight, and it would be to and we can work on the motion, but I think we should.
We've got an idea.
Yeah.
I know that this body meets with the board nearly a year.
Well, yeah, we're supposed to, but last year it was delayed, not by an hour, but.
So before you do that, I mean, I think what Ott brought up is very true. Though this, I'm very, it's stressful getting this, you know, the day of. Going to planning commission work session. I know from being on planning commission, the planning commission went.
I think we need to address this first. That's a bigger underlying issue. I think we need a motion just for this item and possibly even the home based business one if we decide to act on it. Because it goes to planning commission tonight. We're not going to be able to talk to the board first. I think we need to make a motion on these two items. And I guess this one would be that we do not recommend making a change to prohibit single family detached housing in the R12, 18 to 22. Instead, if there is a concern, we recommend addressing it in the minimum lot width and changing it to from 25 to 28. We believe that addresses the concern.
depends what the, I mean, I'm still confused what the actual concern is, whether it's just that people don't like skinny houses or...
What
brought this up? Because if it's somebody doesn't like the look of a skinny house, then we're not going to address it by adding a couple feet to that.
Do you call this a skinny house?
I don't, but yeah. That's... I mean,
feel free to check the passages around. These are both very similar size.
I actually think
there are 17 feet.
Look pretty cool, you know.
Has it been on a diet?
I know the ones that are bringing this up, and they are, I think, 17 or 18 feet wide. And by the way, they're also award-winning houses for efficiency and being able to... They're very livable designs, and they're award-winning homes for energy efficiency.
I think that your idea of having a motion and getting something in front of the PC tonight, both on each individual item here, is great. I don't think, though, we want to recommend anything or specific now until we have a better chance to find out, as you indicated, Steve. What precipitated this?
What's the issue we're
trying
to solve?
What's the issue? Then we can better respond to
exactly.
It with some ideas or some thoughts with regards to that, because nobody's, you know, Jan usually comes to us and sits down and gives us a presentation early in the process and says, hey, this is in response to this, this, and this, and we discuss it, and we discuss it over a couple of meetings, and then we provide recommendations. Here we are trying to shoehorn all of that process into 45 minutes, and that just ain't cool.
One thing we could do is recommend that the Planning Commission continue, basically push it off their agenda. This shouldn't be something that there's an emergency for unless the commissioners are just setting, you know, is it something that can be pushed off the Planning Commission if they so choose for a month or so that we can have a chance to do what we do and try to make a recommendation, advise. It's a thought.
I'll withdraw mine and we can make a motion to.
I'm looking at Jan to see what her staff is. Sometimes with Planning Commission, the staff will say, hey, you've got to do it.
Well, and they've already advertised the hearing. They can still have the hearing and not.
Continue
it.
Because if we as Deep said, hey, we just got this and we'd really like to give some, we have some concerns and we'd like to give you some advice before you proceed.
And they always like to hear from us. Yeah. What are our thoughts?
Yes.
Determined that. Is the Planning Commission still interested in what the Deep has to say?
And I think they are.
Are the Board of Councilors still interested in what Deep has to say?
Yes.
Then we ask for a continuance or a delay or whatever that's called. If no, go ahead. How about it? But I'd like to know what happens to that.
So that just
a confrontational.
I think it's pretty clear that we're going to oppose eliminating or prohibiting single family detached. So we can make a motion to say that. And then the other part of the motion could be that they put this on hold so we can look at it more closely and come up with a better way to address the board's concern. Does that sound like a reasonable approach?
Here's my motion. Are you making a motion?
No.
I haven't asked for one yet.
Yeah.
Okay.
I better not.
No. I'll second.
This would be my motion. Okay. That Deeb request Planning Commission to defer additional review or comment on both of these issues until next month if they are interested in review and comments from this committee.
I second that. That's not really comment.
No, but I think it's more important to tell them that we have significant concerns in that motion.
And we have significant concerns. If they are interested to hear what those concerns are, we would ask for a delay until next month's meeting. So we could have time to review, investigate, review, research, and submit comments.
I'll second that. I like that.
But if they don't, then it'd be good to know that.
And this is on both items?
Huh?
Both items, yeah.
Both items, yeah.
So, do we have discussion, Penn?
Well, yeah, I want to. So just sort of to restate that, we're requesting the Planning Commission to further comment on this
on both these matters until next month if they're interested in deeds input.
We started by saying Deep has significant concerns on these two properties. And we asked that. So that would be my friendly amendment. We stayed into them. We have some significant concerns. Not that we just need more time. We actually don't agree with them. And we'll give them more information if they want it.
Right. Will the commission say, well, why didn't Deep mention their concerns in their requests to us?
We just got it.
They'll understand. I think that's important.
They should understand that.
I think that's important to say.
For the discussion purposes, I have significant concerns, philosophically speaking, on the home occupation thing. I think as a student of planning, the basis for Euclidean zoning is to have separation between land uses and to throw commercial, what I view as commercial development in the middle of residential development. I mean, why not? Why don't we just become Houston at that point? As to the housing one, I think, in fact, I did raise this directly with some of the planning commissioners in an email yesterday, but I'm not sure that the proposal as drafted is actually compliant with the Growth Management Act. And specifically, I'd like to bring this board's attention to RCW 3678-020-4, which is the affordable housing goal, which basically says that, that anybody adopting under the Growth Management Act must have development regulations that are consistent with the Act and goals, and that includes this provision, which encourages availability of housing for all economic segments of the population, promote a variety of densities and housing types. And I'm not sure that this ordinance does that. I think that taking away choice of a developer and letting the market decide which is appropriate for specific developments in this zone that is between what is viewed as maybe typical suburban single-family lots and apartments is not appropriate. Probably not legal.
Especially when arguably those houses, which are separate, are less dense than the attached version.
Yeah.
It's a product issue. It's a choice issue. I mean, all the way.
Do we want to include in our motion and response to the commission the fact that there might be some legal... do you want to include that in with that?
Well, for discussion purposes. I mean, it's odd motion, but I would think that we start giving them comments and advice. I mean, it seems to me that we include that with the rest of our comments when we give them.
Afterwards.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that would be my. It's odd motion though. So.
Well, I would like to include the language that Eric suggested, that we have significant concerns, and they extend from the legal side to the practical side, the technical side.
Philosophical side.
You know, one thing, philosophically, one of these proposals is a liberalization of the rules and uses. The other is a more limited use. Philosophically, they're polar opposites. I don't get that part, but that's not a part of why we're here. But I would refrain from iterating the specifics. We've had, 30 minutes? Yeah, this morning. We've got 30 minutes to look at this thing?
Yeah.
Really?
I think what Mike said might be a good, if you would mind to say, to explain to the Planning Commission that we only just got it today. So that they understand why.
We have comments to make. If they'd like to hear them, we have concerns.
Yes.
Yeah, I would. Jamie, are you okay with that?
Yeah, I think, because I think you touched on it. There's practical, legal, philosophical.
But you've already informed some, have some comments
that's,
on that.
And that's a specific
thing. Sounds like a
great motion. Yeah, sounds like a good one. Holly, did you get all that?
Yeah. Well,
it's been recorded, Kat.
Yeah.
All right, so, off motion, Erica's seconded.
Could we read?
I'm afraid to go.
Yeah. Holly, is there a chance that you can?
Yeah, I'll let.
Okay, here's what I got. Deep has significant concerns regarding legal, technical, practical, and philosophical sides to this issue, and has only just received this today. We recommend the Planning Commission push this off the agenda until next month to allow DEEP to submit comments on both code amendment items.
Do we want to add the subheading, assuming that they want to hear from us? Or I know you mentioned.
I do. I do. Yeah.
If
you
think made the motion. It's too confrontational, we'll leave it off. But
I would err on the side that we're still an advisory board to the Planning Commission and the Board of Counselors, and that if they don't want our input, they can do whatever they want with our input.
We're technically not an advisory board to the Planning Commission.
Oh, that's well, yeah, right.
So this is a courtesy. So they like our input because we bring a different technical angle to it, where they might have that area of expertise. We're technically to the.
You know what? In a way, it's rhetorical. We'll know.
Yeah, to say yes
or not.
Yeah.
So they will leave the second part out or the last part out.
Okay. All right. And Eric, I assume you're still seconding that.
Yes.
All right. Let's have a vote then. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Great.
And to that end, I'd like to go back to what Ott was saying about the fact that we just got this today. I mean, really? Aside from the fact that we need to put the brakes on, hopefully put the brakes on the review by the Planning Commission, how did we not get included in this? Why was this fast-tracked through? And what, because we've never had this discussion about this before, in my recollection. On something that's very significant. I think something was circumvented, something whether intentional or not. But I think this is
intentional. But intentional, yeah. But nevertheless.
This was, you know, I was given some assignments pretty late in the game, and I didn't think to, you know, I knew it was going to come to you, and I didn't think to get you the materials in there. You know, in theory, there's not a lot of language changes, it's pretty simple, but I mean the actual text changes across the body. But it would have, yeah, I apologize for not getting the text in your packet. So that was not
intentional.
The code changes are certainly very limited, easy to see. The impacts are
significant. I did send something along to, who was chair last year?
Last year?
Yes.
Helen.
Tom Mielke.
No,
me.
Did I send you something or did I send something?
No, you said, I'd like to have a time on.
Add something to
the agenda for today to discuss these board generated. Coaching.
And I gave you the nature of what the changes were.
Yep.
So you had, there was some general idea of what it was without the specific code language.
Right.
Okay.
But one thing requesting an item on the agenda,
sure,
to the chair board chair versus sending out the request,
sure,
of code amendments and the background to that to all the members,
yes,
of Steve are a little bit.
I agree. I mean, there's concerns about, it's been the holidays. I mean, things slip through. Everybody's going crazy. James pushing stuff off, but hopefully it's unintentional and something in ramrod in one way or another.
Not to belabor this, but I do think it was well intentioned, the changes, and they were to address concern. But you know, we're here to help try to figure out what those unintended consequences are. So we need to do our job, and that's what it is. So it's not like, you know, I'm not sure. They were well-intentioned, they were board-generated, and the board had a valid concern, but we can prevent them.
Exactly why we put this on.
Yeah, yes. It is.
Well, if there's any intention or omission, it wasn't intentional on the board's part.
Exactly.
I do know that. So.
Don't think it was.
So this will go to, well, hopefully be delayed, but if it goes to Planning Commission hearing, then it would move on to a commissioner's.
Who delivers that tonight?
Yeah, are we going to get that to them at work session?
We want to make sure, yes.
That'd be nice. I'll start them at work session today.
You will deliver that? Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. I think we're ready to move on then to our 2015 work plan and update to revisit our calendar, I think.
I put this mainly as a placeholder, not that we would dive into it right now, but at least start laying the groundwork and kind of dialing this in, kind of talk about what are the next steps, when do we want to prepare for a work session, whether that be with the county counselors or with the county manager. I'm not sure where that'll lie, with the new charter. But nonetheless, I think we need to start dialing in, revisiting our accomplishments and successes with our work plan from last year, the 2014 year, adding any items, new work plan items for 2015 and such. So.
And I could certainly help with putting that together. Last several years, we've actually had an ongoing list that's been updated and with the items that we have that we've talked about originally that have been adopted, that have been resolved, that are still looming out there. It's quite extensive in whether or not they still all apply. And I've got like four or five different versions of that, and I think we could probably take the latest version and update that. As far as the presentation to the board is concerned, that's going to be something that would be a nice tangible for them to see. And then come up with anything else on that anybody else might have. I don't know if there's anything new that we want to address this year, but I can certainly look at putting that together, at least what we've done, the notes that I have from our last discussion about this, and then send it out to everyone so that we can at least get an input and start maybe next month's meeting, really start focusing on what's going to be important. I was going to ask Marty if there was going to be another biannual code amendment revision this year in the spring or fall, so that's usually something we do.
They skipped the fall one, I think, right?
They skipped all last year. So I don't know if anybody has anything they want to address at this point in time.
These two items would be something that would normally be covered in those biannuals, and we would probably have more of a review by skipping them and doing the emergency ones. That might have been the unintended consequence of skipping those. The normal process it goes through didn't happen, so it would have went twice before, and that didn't happen this time.
So let me take a look at that. I've got the master list, and I'll go ahead and update it with what we've kind of done, or at least filled in the status portion of that, and then send it out to everyone we can discuss next month.
Excellent. Thank you, Mike. So, of course, it looks like our agenda is maybe a little bit lighter in February as it is anyway, and so we'll certainly dedicate time for that. Once the members receive that from Mike, I'd ask please do take a look at that updated list, any comment that you may have, and then please come with any ideas of items to add to the work plan as we look at 2015, 2016, and we can start to pull that list together.
I was thinking about an item next month. I'd be curious to find out if Paul or Gordy where the comp plan is now, as we're doing it here.
Because they were going to come to us quarterly,
and I think it's been since last summer.
They're probably doing that.
I'll get with Oliver on that.
There are two other items in some kind of semi-DU communication, and we didn't have a section on here, but I know Greg and I were involved. There was a subcommittee last year with the horizontal curb cutting for driveway drops. And that came up. There's probably some miscommunication. I just got emailed directly, and I passed it on to Greg just to see where it was. And I think there was just some miscommunication. But perhaps when they do come up with a formal proposal for how we're going to handle those, I think that should come to this board for review and comment before it just gets put into code and policy.
Okay.
So we have to provide some feedback.
Standard details
on it. There's horizontal curb cuts. So right now, any driveway that goes, if you're having to tear out all the curb and pour this deep curb, basically, and there's a procedure for horizontally cutting it. And if done right, it looks pretty good. If done improperly, it's a mess. So again, it's regulating to the lowest common denominator.
They came to us.
Did we talk about that last February?
We did.
Yeah.
And it was implemented by us, but then I don't think it made that way to staff. And staff had a new, I don't know, it got cleared up in one email, and Greg had it cleared up in, I think, minutes. But they're still refining the detail. So once we have that detail and the policy set, I think the board should review it quickly at least and make a formal recommendation on it. The other one was something I heard from Ali about, and it goes into one of our goals, which was streamlining process and engineering. And what I've heard recently is the county used to allow engineering review to happen concurrently with post-decision reviews. And because of the workload and staffing issues, they're not doing anything that's not mandated. So being able to provide engineering reviews concurrent with post-decision reviews are not happening right now. They don't have the workload. And I understand that because you guys are pushed. But I think a policy of perhaps allowing first engineering review to happen while some of these changes are even during an application could really save a lot of time. So it goes in that streamlining. I'd like to add that maybe to our work plan to come up with ways to streamline plans. And even allowing first review to happen during the prelim before we have the conditions. What I've found, the city allows that. And what we found is we get better staff reports because a lot of these things are fleshed out with the first engineering review. And it's better. We're not doing post-decision reviews as often because we get better comments because they're reviewing more finalized documents.
We've done that.
Yeah, not anymore. We've done it. I just heard about it. We've done it too. And the staff was, the position was that they would allow concurrent post-decision reviews and engineering reviews. I just had them kicked out with a new, and I understand it. I understand that there's resource allocation issues, but like I said, you've done it, we've done it, and that policy is just changed.
It's almost become the norm.
It has become the norm, but not anymore. That's why I'm bringing it up here.
Okay.
So who's the director of that department?
I am.
Great. And that was a thing too. I said, you guys do, I understand you probably do have staffing issues and resources, and there's a high workload right now. So anything not mandated to do, they're not doing that as a courtesy anymore. And I understand if your project's getting pushed for something that's not mandated and you're mandated, you gotta figure out what to cut.
Huh.
But I think we can do it better. So if
we'll definitely let's get it on the work plan and we'll start to work on that.
So those are two items I'd like to bring up to the work plan. The first one was the horizontal curb cut. Yeah.
I don't know if anyone else wants to offer any other thoughts as far as work plan, or if we just plan to discuss that a little bit more next month. Hopefully fill in that calendar a little bit. I frankly am not caught up on what next month's agenda looks like exactly either, so probably a good conversation piece.
Looks like the only thing we have going on is the TIF update on the TIF program.
TIF update, we'll add Jamie's request on the comp plan update and status of that.
Right.
And I think Jamie earlier in the meeting had also mentioned the move to the residential impact fee delays. So. February's full again.
All right, I think we're down to public comment.
Go ahead. I just want to give an update on our stormwater design manual. Also make a plug to consider it for your work plan. That'll be a pretty significant effort. We'll be input from this group on our code and design. It's kind of fallen off the page a little bit from delays from the Department of Ecology, but just a reminder, it's out there and it's a big deal. But we do have, we have a technical advisory committee meeting on January 28th. There are some members in here that participate in that. I haven't met in a while. We're me broader policy issues that we've identified through the process, some decisions we can potentially make for our design manual and our design standards, and also some process issues that we need input from our practitioners. So that'll be in at the end of January. For the overall process, just as a reminder, we submitted our draft design manual to the Department of Ecology at the end of June for a 90-day review on their part. It's an equivalency review for them to say, for our first cut at our new design manual, it will be equivalent with the state's manual. That 90-day we should have that 90-day review back by September, but we don't have it back yet. It was mainly due to permit modification and a new state design manual or stormwater manual that they just reissued. So how that plays out in our permit is essentially for every day after September that they're late getting back to us, our deadline to adopt the design manual and code next year pushes a day. In other words, if they would have given it back to us by the end of September, we would have had to adopt it by June 30, 2015. Now we're looking at, you know, at least from September to now. My guess is that they'll give us our equivalency review and comments on our draft manual. I'm going to guess February. They'll quote me on that. So if they do that, we'll have basically 9 months from then to adopt and make effective the new design manual and code. So we're looking October to December next year. So there'll be a little bit more time until those new codes become effective. a slight push in the schedule, a little more time, and we will, particularly when we get comments back from Department of Ecology, engage our advisory committees more fully as we kind of push to the finish line. But don't forget about that, as I'm sure you haven't. It's out there and coming, and we're picking up the process. So.
Last year, the Board of County Commissioners did approve the contract for the new permit system. They approved that December 16th, so we have the kickoff starting toward the end of February, so that's going to be my next 20 months of work.
Looking forward to the update. Any other comments? I guess we are adjourned.
Thank you. Yeah. Oh, thank you.